Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, friends. This is Saturday morning, and it's the Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystal and Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning.
Andre,
how
are you with
you?
Us? I think Andre's here, but we'll let him chime in when he can. I am good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
I'm glad to hear it. You know, hey, it's December the 22nd, 2012. Welcome to the new world.
And we're still here.
The old world has passed away. And all things are becoming new, as Jesus promised. And this show is a continuation of last week's show, which was very well received. And, of course, we wanted to address this topic for quite a while, and that is family as the master civilizer. And this week, we delved deeply into some of the teachings in general of the Urantia book last week. This week, we want to hone in more on Jesus and how Jesus dealt with family issues and family matters, for he did do that, and how he modeled an ideal family for the entire universe, for his universe, and trillions of beings, of ascending beings throughout his universe, and millions of inhabited worlds. And so to that end, I played one of my favorite Christmas songs by the great James Taylor, Some Children See Him. And it's so true. He's dear to all of us who love him, and we see him in our own unique and special way. And he ministers to us in a unique and special way. So I think that's why I love that song. So we're going to talk about Jesus and the family, and especially how Jesus dealt with family matters, and as I said. And we hope to have some guests call in. We've lined some folks up who really are experts on this subject and have given it a lot of thought, and especially as regards the teachings of the Urantia book. So I think the quote, and Andre, are you with us?
I can read the quote.
Can you read the quote? Isn't Andre area code 816?
819.
Oh, he's 819. Well, I've been thinking this is Andre, and it's not. It might be just a listener or somebody else who's calling in. 816, you're with us online.
Hello?
Erica? 816?
Hi, it's the usual Kansas City girl, Lee.
Oh, hi, sweetheart. Okay, good.
Yeah,
well,
so
I'll get these.
I'm going to be calling in every week, and so, you know, that's always going to be showing up right at the top of the hour.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, but I loved the show last week, and I'm looking forward to it this week, and... Oh, hey, I'm sorry to interrupt, but as long as I'm online, do you mind if I mention what's happening on Symmetry of the Soul on Christmas night?
Oh, no, go right ahead.
Well, Tuesday night is the regular night for Symmetry of Soul. And so they're still having the broadcast, but for that particular one on Christmas Day, they're inviting all Urantia book readers to call in and talk about what this celebration of Christmas means to them.
Great. Perfect. And that is Symmetry of Soul, which is another Blog Talk Radio program.
Yes.
With
on Tuesday nights.
Right. Chris Halverson, Ann Garner, James Woodward, and Dennis Kermit. Anderson. Kermit Anderson. Right. So,
yes,
and that's there's a lot of folks that like to tune into that show as well. So that's great.
You.
I'm glad they're doing it on Christmas night. That's wonderful.
I know, I'm really looking forward to it, but I'm also really looking forward to your show today.
Okay, good. Well, Lee, it's so great to have you on.
Well, if I ever did want to say something, could I just press 1? Would that work?
Yep.
Okay.
So
great.
You're just listening for now, but if I see your cue, I'll put you through.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, Godspeed to you both, and love you both.
Love
and
you.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, thank you. Okay, bye.
Bye. Okay.
So
good.
One of the quotes that we posted, which we read part of last week, and we've read around this paper last week, but we're going to read this again and just talk about what Jesus meant by this. It's from paper 177, section 2, paragraph 2. He's talking to John Mark on his day afternoon with the Master. He says, I know you will prove loyal to the gospel of the kingdom because I can depend upon your present faith and love when these qualities are grounded upon such an early training as has been your portion at home. You are the product of a home where the parents bear each other a sincere affection, and therefore you have not been overloved so as injuriously to exalt your concept of self-importance. Neither has your personality suffered distortion in consequence of your parents' loveless maneuvering for your confidence and loyalty, the one against the other. Just that one quote is rich with implications for better family and interpersonal management.
Well, so yeah, you know, and we touched on that a little bit last week. You know, it really begins right there with a solid relationship, a solid foundation for the mother and father.
Indeed. And, you know, he talks about injurious, you know, overlove,
mm-hmm.
and distorting, you know, false love.
So expound on that a little bit. I mean, you know, that just those just that phrase or those two those words in combination, injurious overlove.
Well, or injuriously to exalt your concept of self-importance.
Right.
You know, and because the parents loved one another with sincere affection, they probably didn't, you know, put all their eggs in one basket, so to speak, and just, you know, pile on all of their needs and all of their wants for affection onto this child. And then the distortion, the consequence of distortion in a loveless maneuvering, that's, I think, pretty easy to understand. It's kind of when it's very manipulative and where the focus is really about getting something from the child. And I think also from one of the other parenting handbooks that has been important in my life, Redirecting Children's Misbehavior, one of the points they make is that it's equally important for a child to learn self-respect as well as respect for others.
Mm-hmm.
That if either of those is missing, there's going to be some sort of fatal flaw or some difficulty in understanding interpersonal relationships. And I think that's really important. So often you see people who have one or the other. They either have, you know, a tremendous amount of, an attitude of self-love or self-aggrandizement. And I know in contemporary psychology, self-love is considered really important. But frequently there isn't enough emphasis placed on genuine respect for others, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, and the book says uncategorically that one is the measure of the other. I mean, you can't love yourself more than you love your fellows. And, you know, you can't respect yourself more than you love your fellows. One is the measure of the other. And I think, you know, and I'm also reminded of Jesus in that great discourse, Instruction for Teachers and Believers, where he says, you know, we've come to restore the self-esteem in those who don't have it and restrain it in those who do.
Right.
And it's a balance, you know, and I think the Urantia book reiterates over and over again the dangers of self-love. Not self-respect, not
right.
self-esteem, but self-love. And I think that, you know, a wise parent, which, you know, the problem is, you know, we have so few examples, but we do have Jesus, and which is beautiful, and Jesus in the Urantia book, and it's just so rich with his family life and with his ways of doing things. And of course he dealt with all of humanity as a family, you know. He called humans often my children, my little children. And, you know, that's the way he felt about us. So he was like the greatest example of parenthood that's ever lived on the planet. And to have these ideas of his, these concepts of parenting, especially in this section, you know, it's the section is really incredible. And I highly recommend that that anybody who can read it again who's interested in this topic, because it's from paper 177, Wednesday, the day of rest. Jesus is nearing the end of his life. There's a great deal of tension with the apostles. He said certain things that have led them to believe that he's not going to be with them for very long, and he takes his day to just rest. He wants to go out on the hills by himself. And here's this wonderful young teenager who has spent a great deal of time with Jesus and the apostles, and he loves them. He's devoted to them. He's devoted to Jesus. Oh, he just adores Jesus for all the right reasons. And he's been with them, and he's been serving them, and he's been doing whatever he can to help. And even though he's not an apostle, he really is. In my heart, he really is. And you know, Jesus wants to go off by himself, and here they are. They have this basket of food prepared, and John Mark is handing him this basket of food to take with him as he goes off to go off by himself, but he won't let go of the basket. So here's Jesus on one side with his hand on the basket and John Mark on the other with his, and Jesus is trying to take the basket, but John won't let it go. It's such a vivid story, and John Mark really wants to go with Jesus. And he says, you know, I won't be any trouble. I'll just be near at hand. And if you need anything, I'll be there for you. And all of the apostles would have loved to have gone with Jesus on this day. But John Mark made bold to essentially insist, to ask, please, let me go. And Jesus, being the person he was, said, okay, since you really want this, let's go. And the book goes on to say that it's known on high as the day that a boy spent in the hills alone with God. And of course, Jesus, being who he was, knows that this young man is getting ready to, thinking about finding somebody, and, you know, very soon, in the next, you say, 5-10 years, he's going to start a family. So what does Jesus do? He gives him the most practical advice about these matters. And he tells him, you know, this is why you're who you are. You came from this home where love reigns and wisdom rules, and, you know, what Crystalline just read.
These and let me finish reading that paragraph.
Yeah, go ahead.
He says, you've enjoyed that parental love which ensures laudable self-confidence and which fosters normal feelings of security. But you have also been fortunate in that your parents possessed wisdom as well as love. And it was wisdom which led them to withhold most forms of indulgence and many luxuries which wealth can buy, while they sent you to the synagogue school along with your neighborhood playfellows. And they also encouraged you to learn how to live in this world by permitting you to have original experience. You came over to the Jordan where we preached and John's disciples baptized with your young friend Amos. Both of you desired to go with us. When you returned to Jerusalem, your parents consented. Amos's parents refused. They loved their son so much that they denied him the blessed experience which you have had, even such as you this day enjoy. By running away from home, Amos could have joined us, but in so doing, he would have wounded love and sacrificed loyalty. Even if such a course had been wise, it would have been a terrible price to pay for experience, independence, and liberty. Wise parents such as yours see to it that their children do not have to wound love or stifle loyalty in order to develop independence and enjoy invigorating liberty when they have grown up to your age. That's pretty profound.
Well, and think of that. I mean, I think this is so poignant for us in this life. And, you know, because the topic and in this day, because the topic that we're talking about is, and have been talking about for since last week, is how we can build stronger families in this troubled world. And here's a concept that right now, and I think I shared this on the air, maybe not, but, you know, we had a terrible event happen here in my neighborhood just in the last few months where a precious little 10-year-old child was kidnapped and murdered by a 17-year-old boy. And it was very traumatic. It was very, very traumatic for me because I have a beautiful 17-year-old daughter here at home. And her independence is very important to me. The fact that she can go to school, she can drive herself to school, she drives herself to work, she's the most competent and responsible young person, and I just so appreciate her. But suddenly I was thrust into this world of fear for my child, and especially before they caught this fellow, and nobody knew who he was, what was he doing? You know, and the whole circumstances of it was horrific. And what everybody went through, not just the mother and father of this beautiful child, but everybody in the whole community, my whole community, was just in agony over this. And, you know, it made the national news. But when it hit so close to home, like we can imagine what the parents of children in Newtown, Connecticut, are feeling right now. You want to hover over your child, you know. And at one point, it had gotten pretty bad, where I was just a wreck, and I was texting May, my daughter, every 20 minutes. Where are you? What are you doing? And I never do that to her. And I had to dig down deep into my faith and just know that she's safe and that she's smart. And that angels are watching over her as they do all children. And sometimes, you know, bad things happen on this world. But by making my child a prisoner in my care, I'm doing her a tremendous disservice, and I'm doing a disservice to myself. And at one point, I even apologized to her. I said, "May, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, honey. I won't do this to you anymore. I'm just gonna, you know, buck up." And I also realized that, you know, looking out my window where the little kids meet for the bus stop, where there were, you know, usually 10 little kids standing there waiting for the bus on a bright sunny morning. Before now, at this point in time, there are 10 little kids and 10 parents all standing at the bus stop together. And I think that's a good thing, but I remember as a child how sweet and special it was to feel independent a little bit and to feel safe in the world and not have somebody feeling like they had to hover over you all the time. So I just think there's so much wisdom in this. He elaborates by saying, you know, this boy Amos, he could have run away and had the same experience that your parents willingly let you have. But in so doing, he would have wounded love and sacrificed loyalty. And that's a terrible price to pay for experience, independence, and liberty. I think it's so important that children have that opportunity to experience life, you know, when they're ready. And of course, here is Amos and John Mark. They're responsible teenagers of their day. Really, I mean, how old do you think John Mark was? 16?
Probably, yeah.
16. So I don't know if they ever say how old he was. But
well, we know he was a teenager,
yeah.
a
man in the eyes of Jewish tradition. He would have been a man.
If at 13 they become a man, then he could have been anything over 13.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's such a folly, I think, for parents to be overly protective of their kids. And yet, in today's world, it's really, you know, got to be fearful for many parents to give their children that independence and to trust them to make wise choices.
And here again, too, you know, if you've done your job, you feel like you've done your job pretty well. It's like my experience with May. I had to dig down and realize, okay, look, she's a smart kid. She knows what she's doing. She's in touch.
She's wise beyond her years.
She has her phone. She has her wits about her. I've given her everything I can to develop a good character and to develop a sense of consciousness of what's going on around her. So on some level, I have to trust that I've given her all that I can and allow her to sail, you know? Allow her the freedom that and the liberty that she's earned and not make her feel like she'll be betraying my loyalty to do something she feels is right to do, to have an experience that she believes would be beneficial to her. You know, and I think of my own parents gave me that opportunity. They were so willing to let me learn by doing. You know,
mine
Jesus,
too.
Yeah. And isn't that the pearl of great price?
Mm-hmm.
If you trust your children, if you have faith in them, then they have something to lose. You know, and now hopefully they're making their decisions for the right reasons based on their own understanding and their wisdom and their, you know, and I know children are vulnerable in this world. We all know that. And we have to be careful. And that's just the reality. But sometimes reality just comes rushing in like a tsunami.
Right.
And there's no way out of it. So, you know, I guess I would rather give my child an opportunity to have an independent experience and learn and grow than to feel hovered over.
And Jesus really trusted the universe, too.
Mm-hmm.
He trusted the celestial beings who watched over him and each of us. And he said that, I trust that I live in a friendly universe and that all of those powers are conspiring to keep me safe and to take care of me in spite of all evidence to the contrary.
Right.
And even if he was killed, even if some painful situation occurred, he had faith that he was going to be able to find the strength to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the other really great examples of that was his relationship with his younger brother, Jude. you know, where some difficult circumstances did befall them because of Jude's self-righteousness, self-righteous indignation.
Right.
You know, when they were traveling in Jerusalem and Jude shot his mouth off to the Roman soldiers and he ended up getting arrested. And they spent the entire weekend, the entire holiday weekend in jail, basically waiting, wasn't it? Or was it just overnight?
Well,
I can't remember.
I think it was overnight, but then they went the next day before the magistrate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another great example. And maybe after we finish, you know, reading this one, and let's read the rest of this story and Jesus' advice. And then go and let's look up that one, too. I can look it up in an instant here.
Okay.
Because that's such an important point. How did Jesus react in that situation? And it's just invaluable. You know, I have a feeling that, a belief that oftentimes families give up on each other too easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's to the detriment of everyone involved. But and I want to point out just one more thing about the paragraph that you just read, Crystalline, because Sun Sister on the board said this, and it's so true. Children do need sensible parameters, and a wise parent provides that too. And sometimes parents can be too liberal and nonchalant, you know.
Well, like they say in the beginning, the overindulged.
Right, right. Yeah, you got to do what you got to do and go for it. Or even neglected. Sometimes it's parental neglect, you know. I just don't want to get involved with what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much work for me.
I don't have time.
I don't have time. I'm too busy. I have a career. I have other things I've got going
on. There's important things to do.
Right, right. So read that next paragraph.
Love, John, is the supreme reality of the universe when bestowed by all wise beings. But it is a dangerous and oft-times semi-selfish trait, as it is manifest in the experience of mortal parents. When you get married and have children of your own to rear, make sure that your love is admonished by wisdom and guided by intelligence. Should I read on?
Yeah.
Your young friend Amos believes this gospel of the kingdom just as much as you, but I cannot fully depend upon him. I am not certain about what he will do in the years to come. His early home life was not such as would produce a wholly dependable person. Amos is too much like one of the apostles who failed to enjoy a normal, loving, and wise home training. Your whole afterlife will be more happy and dependable because you spent your first 8 years in a normal and well-regulated home. You possess a strong and well-knit character because you grew up in a home where love prevailed and wisdom reigned. Such a childhood training produces a type of loyalty which assures me that you will go through with the course you have begun.
That is just so thought-provoking. Now, he says, he's you know, guess which apostle he's referring to here?
Judas.
Yes, Judas. And they do a whole psychological profile on Judas, but one of the things that they say about him is that he was a good example of what Jesus was talking about here, of a person who was overindulged and had too high of an opinion of himself. Let's just put it that way. And he couldn't accept anything that Jesus would say that wasn't in agreement with what he already held to be true.
With his pet beliefs.
With his pet beliefs. And so, you know, him telling John Mark, your young friend Amos believes this gospel just as much as you do, but I cannot fully depend upon him. I'm not certain about what he will do in the years to come. You know, that's intriguing to me because this is Jesus. This is also Michael. But there's a factor in human development that says, you know, it's free will is conditioned by certain things, and it becomes unpredictable even for a personality like Jesus, who said, you know, this is essentially an eternal person. And before Abraham was, I am. I know. I understand. But I can't be certain what this person will do in years to come. That's intriguing to me. His early home life was not such as would produce a wholly dependable person. What is the kind of person that other people can depend on? What are those characteristics? How do you instill that in a child? Because in another place in the Urantia book, it tells us that children learn more from our loyalties. That example and even precept are not lastingly influential, but our loyalties are. So if we are loyal to truth, if we are loyal to honesty, if we are loyal to integrity, if we are loyal to a work ethic. I mean, that's how I understand that. And to make a child feel like they can't do anything wrong is a mistake.
You know, I think that's a really important thing, too, is that, you know, confiding in one another, trusting one another, giving each other the benefit of the doubt, you know, for as long as possible when we're dealing with our fellows is really important. But there's a certain point at which wisdom also has to function alongside and that trust. And if someone has consistently betrayed trusts, when someone has consistently or has not consistently lived up to walking the talk,
mm-hmm.
You know, then I think that there's reason for us to say, well, you know, I love you. I want what's best for you, but I don't really feel like I can fully, wholly depend on you to, you know, do what you say you're going to do or to come through when the going gets rough.
Mm-hmm. And you'll probably cut and run and do what you feel is best for you.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean
to. No, I just think that that wisdom and discernment plays an important role.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently we use various kinds of excuses to avoid utilizing discernment. You know, one of the popular ones now is sort of to say, well, you're just being too judgmental.
Yeah.
But at certain points, we are sort of required to use our discernment, and I think that's what he means by wisdom.
Right. Well, how can we come to the truth of a matter if we don't ever bother to discuss it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's you know, and something I meant to mention last week is this practice of the family meeting. I think we did touch on it briefly.
Just very briefly.
Yeah, just very briefly, this idea that the family gets together and talks about these issues and discusses them in all sincerity. And I remember my own father, you know, whenever there was a pressing issue on the family where, say, somebody had done something that hurt somebody else within the family, he often would say, well, we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about this as a family. And we're going to get it off our chest. And we're going to clear the air. And then we're going to move on. He simply refused to allow that to hang to hang over the family, you know what I mean? To hang in the air. And sometimes you just feel it. There's a tension and resentment that just grows if you don't deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So his, and of course, being a policeman, he dealt with a lot of, I mean, he was called upon to go into difficult family situations as an outsider, where men and women were actually harming each other, and many times in front of their children, and mediate it, and try to get everybody's story, right, both sides, and try to diffuse that anger. And being the person he was, he cared more about helping that family. You know, the policeman, it says, to serve and protect. That's who he was in his heart of hearts. He was there to serve and protect. He wasn't there to judge or blame or shame anyone. He just wanted to diffuse the situation and allow calmness and restore balance to it.
Hmm.
And he was good at it. And he got good at it because he had to do it so much. And so in his own family, he knew, we're just going to deal with this head on. We're not going to try to shuffle it under the table or, you know, hide it or pretend like it doesn't exist.
That,
but we're going to rationally
discuss it. And that is so important.
Yeah.
It's so important, and yet this is something that is so common. This avoidance, you know, this sort of denial avoidance process where we don't want to talk about it. It's going to be uncomfortable. You know, let's just either put it off or not deal with it because it's you know, it might cause some rift.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that he mentions in that paragraph is the sense of security that comes from being well-loved. And I think a lot of the insecurity that we experience or that we observe in the world really comes from this sense of not being safe at home, not being loved at home, you know, not having, not only not having a wise parental influence, but pretty much having like no parental influence. Parents who are either physically or emotionally absent.
Right.
And that, or a feeling that they're not really, you can't really be sure that they're going to be there for you. You can't really be sure that you can count on them being in your corner. Because
wow,
any number of other issues might be more important to them. And, you know, in today's materialistic world, I mean, frequently it's earning a living or some other focus that is more important. I think that there's a lot of semi-selfish love that he describes going on out there under the guise of a real parental love. And for people who haven't had the kind of wise parental influence that you did with your father, I think it's all too common.
I agree, and you know, and no family is perfect, and but I did experience as a child the sense, and I would say that my parents were probably too liberal, but I was their fourth child, and by the time I came along, they were more laid back. I guess they figured I was going to be fine. You'll be fine. You know.
The other ones have survived so far, so Paula will probably do that too.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and I see that, and I've talked to other people about that, and they said, yeah, I experienced that too, especially if they were later in the family, you know, and not the first or second. And my oldest daughter, Jean, likes to tell me, yeah, I'm your first child, Mom. You made all your mistakes on me, you know. And it's so cute. She understands that, you know. And so we all deal with different situations, but I think you've touched on something that's so important. And one of the things that I treasure more about my own nuclear family than anything else is that I knew without a doubt that my parents loved each other. And because I knew that, that brought so much security into my life. That brought a sense of profound security to me. No matter what else was happening, I knew their love for each other was real. And I saw it daily. It was nothing for me to walk into the kitchen and see my mom and dad in an embrace. And it was a soulful embrace. Just, I love you so, so much. Embrace. And the last thing I would hear at night as I drifted off to sleep was them telling each other how much they loved each other as they drifted off to sleep.
Oh, that's so sweet. Never heard you tell that story before.
Yeah, it was very special.
And that has to be really confidence-inducing in children.
You know, when they celebrated one of their anniversaries, I know my mom, you know, in a way when my dad died, we lost her too because she never really recovered from that. But one of their anniversaries, I was a teenager and I wrote them a little poem and I gave it to them in the card and it was simply this, a simple little poem. It said, "I know why you love me, Dad and Mother. It's very plain to see. It's simply because you love each other. You couldn't help loving me."
Aww.
And it's a very real sentiment, a sentiment that a child understands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Jesus is getting at when he says, where love reigns. It's
mm-hmm.
like, it doesn't matter. Nothing else matters except that how much we love each other. That
mm-hmm.
matters most. We get
yeah.
that right. And that's like the kingdom of heaven, right? And everything needful will be added.
Mm-hmm.
In a family, you get that right, and everything else is good.
Yeah.
And I remember kids telling me, because the love that my parents felt for each other was so real that other kids could feel it when they came to
mm-hmm.
my house. They didn't have to see the fond embraces or hear the goodnight, I love you, love yous, to feel the love in the house.
Yeah,
and they used to tell me, "I wish your mom and dad were my mom and dad."
Mm-hmm.
That always struck me. Wow, really? Why? I mean, it took me a lifetime to figure out why they would say that. But they felt my parents' love for each other. So there is the first basic building block of a family right there. Mom and dad and how they feel about each other.
Right.
And if it's a sham, that's not a good thing. Children see through that. My own husband had an experience with his nuclear family where his parents fought so much when they finally divorced, the whole family was relieved. Oh, my God, you guys finally figured it out. It's something we've known all along. You don't belong together. We're glad
you were just making
talk.
Each other miserable.
Yeah, that's the other
side
of it.
I'm also reminded of we had a worship service in the last 5 or so years. I can't remember exactly when it was, where I believe you were the one who was asking the question, who was speaking. You were talking about how many people here felt like they had perfect parents. Was that you or was that
No,
Andre?
I think that was Andre.
Andre.
It was Andre Westa.
And, there's this sort of assumption that everybody in the crowd is going to say, well, none of us had perfect parents. But my brother and his kids were in the audience, and both of his kids' hands shot up. Do you remember that?
Oh, God, I love it. That was one of the most precious things I've ever seen because it was so spontaneous and sincere. Little Sidney Ray and Nathaniel sitting in the audience, and when he asked that question, their hands shot up without hesitation.
That was pretty sweet.
And
was
so
pretty
true.
Sweet.
And you see that in them. You see that in those two children, and your brother and his family are a good example of what we're talking about here. A strong and loving couple who have created a normal and well-regulated, those are Jesus' words, normal and well-regulated home. And that goes back to what we touched on last week, and I think it's so important, and we're really talking about it right now, and that is when two people love each other and they work together, the power that they can, the things that they can create together become exponentially greater than either one of them could create alone. And when they're strong and stable, they create a home that is strong and stable.
And I look at my my brother's wife's family, and I think, wow, that is also a really good example of a family that truly enjoys being together.
Mm-hmm.
They really love one another. They're three girls and an intact parental unit. And their mother is just the most motherly, loving, sort of there for you kind of person. And the father is also, but in a very different way. I mean, very masculine way of parenting, different from a motherly way of parenting. And it's really wonderful to see the kind of genuine affection that they have for one another. And, you know, at holidays, when we spend the holidays with them, it's really great to hear, you know, inevitably somebody will say, well, tell us a story about, you know,
mm-hmm.
how you guys got together.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to parents talk about how they fell in love or how they met and how that relationship grew is a really special thing to share.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people who genuinely love one another are usually fairly comfortable talking about that and sharing
Correct.
That experience.
Right. And, you know, and people who, and I think you bring up a very good point, that people like to be near that. They like to associate with that. They like to associate with loving people. And because it mirrors that, you know, for them, it models that. And, you know, how lucky we were to have the life of Jesus and how lucky we are, I should say, to have it. And these essential lessons that he taught that we didn't get before and that we have now. It's so beautiful.
And
it's
also
so beautiful to be near that. Go ahead.
I also think about the experience of my mom and her second husband, Jerry, who passed away just a couple months ago. And just how they were sort of a model of a love found later in life, but of a couple who just were really devoted to one another. And my stepdaughter, Reagan, had the good fortune of, you know, spending weekends with them on a regular basis for many years, even after her father and I had split up. And it was really gratifying to me to know that she had one really stable mentor couple in her life, as you know, with her grandparents, that they would always be considerate and loving towards her, no matter what. Even if they were in a bad mood, if one of them was in a bad mood, that she could count on there not being a lot of strife in that household.
Right. And that feeds a child.
It really does.
It feeds a child to be in an environment like that. And so, you know, when we're talking about the very basic fundamentals of home building, you know, I can't think of any other way that we might help our culture and our civilization to do better at this beyond education and helping young people how to decide on a life mate. How to, you know, because it starts with that first decision. I want to be married to you, and I want to raise a family with you. How do you decide who that person is? What is it you're looking for? What's going to make the two of you happy and stable? You know, and the Urantia book also has an awful lot to say about this, preparing young people. It's just like Jesus. Perfect example. Here's Jesus. He knows he has a young man. He knows this young man is going to be settling down at some point to have a family probably, and he's going to give him some very practical information about who he is, why he is the way he is, and what he might want to do. And what's so important too, and we'll go on to this next paragraph because it's just vitally important. He gives him the reason why being a parent is probably the most important job you'll ever have. It is, without a doubt. It is the most important job you'll ever have. There is no job more important.
And
more
it's also
vital.
A required course
and
in our universe ascension process.
So true. It is a required course. And just a reminder for our listeners, we're talking about family as the master civilizer and restoring the family. And we're specifically honing in on what Jesus had to say about these things this week. And,
not only what Jesus had to say, but also how he did it.
Right. And if you'd like to call in and share your comments with us, your thoughts, our number is 646-716-8158. And Lee, if you have any thoughts, push the button. We'll put you on. So go ahead, Krislyn, read that next paragraph. For more than an hour.
For more than an hour, Jesus and John continued this discussion of home life. The master went on to explain to John how a child is wholly dependent on his parents and the associated home life for all his early concepts of everything intellectual, social, moral, and even spiritual, since the family represents to the young child all that he can first know of either human or divine relationships. The child must derive his first impressions of the universe from the mother's care. He is wholly dependent on the earthly father for his first ideas of the heavenly father. A child's subsequent life is made happy or unhappy, easy or difficult, in accordance with his early mental and emotional life. Conditioned by the social and spiritual relationships of the home, a human being's entire afterlife is enormously influenced by what happens during the first few years of existence. It is our...
Go ahead.
Do you want me to pause here?
Well, let's clarify that this is not really what Jesus said, but it's the midwayer's commentary on what he said, which I appreciate and love dearly, because they have such great and keen insights into the human condition. And so it's them that says that the first few years can affect the entire afterlife. And Jesus, you know, we mentioned this last week too. You said Jesus said the first 8 years, and you're right.
It happened in the previous paragraph where he
said that, and then the midwayers make a commentary on what Jesus was saying, and then they're going on to expound on it, which they love to do, and I love them for that.
And you know, it's not that we would say, you know, parents shouldn't work during the, you know, early years of their children's lives, or that, you know, we as good families, we shouldn't have any other focus in our life other than our children for those early years. Because, I mean, you yourself as a parent, you had to be a working mom.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's an understanding that while it is important for us to work and make a living, keep food on the table, keep a roof over our head, that what really gives kids a sense of feeling of security is that wholehearted focus of maternal and paternal affection.
Mm-hmm.
A sense that, you know, it's your parents are really taking care of you.
And, you know, I love this concept that the child's, you know, their first impressions of the universe comes from the mother's care. Imagine what a huge responsibility that is. But it's the greatest responsibility there is. I mean, it's an experience that has more rewards and more benefits in terms of understanding the importance of God's love and of the universe's sustenance.
And you think about how much energy, effort, and attention it takes to really care lovingly, wholeheartedly, and wisely for your children in those first early years. It really is a full-time job. I mean, it really does require a tremendous amount of effort, but they grow up so fast.
Well, that's true.
They grow up so fast that even if you are completely devoted to that for that period of time in your life, that time is going to go by so quickly. And you hear of parents saying all the time, oh, my God, they grew up too fast. I can't believe she's already, you know, graduating from high school. I mean, it seems like only yesterday, you know, we were gathered around in the hospital waiting for her to be born.
And, you know, what? It's just such a precious responsibility and such a sacred one and such a beautiful one. To have a precious little child in your life that you can love and teach and learn from and share with and experience life with. And, you know, we all fall short of the ideal of that Jesus held up for us. But I think children, first and foremost, if they are loved, they appreciate that. And they know they are loved.
Well,
they know you don't always do the right thing and you make mistakes. And
I
you
don't
say,
think they expect you to do the right thing.
Not always.
I mean, I don't know very many children who really have held on resentment because their parents made mistakes.
No, I don't either.
They're much more likely to feel resentment or to feel, you know, frustration or judgmental when they've just felt abandoned or they haven't felt like you were there.
Just let down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think
if they
also,
thought you didn't care. Right.
And, you know, one of the ways in which kids frequently feel like you don't care, and this is quite ironic, but if there isn't any discipline, if there aren't any parameters or there aren't any boundaries, kids can sort of feel like they need to push the boundaries and they need to test those boundaries. I mean, I think that's a normal part of growing up. But when they push against those boundaries and find that they aren't there, they can really feel like they don't have what they need.
Right, because they're smart enough to know they don't know everything. They don't want to feel like they're out there floundering with no place to turn when they get into a difficult situation or when they get stuck. By the same token, a wise parent will let them suffer the consequences of their own foolish actions.
Indeed, and that's really difficult for a lot of people.
Yes, isn't that the truth? You want to protect them. You feel like that's your job, but, you know, it's also your job to let them learn.
And to let them fail.
Right. Right. And to not, you know, I think one of the mistakes that I see parents making often is they think that their child's failure is somehow a reflection upon them.
Mm.
You know, and we just read not long ago in study group from the Jesus Papers about mistakes and about how mistakes are essential to our growth, to our ability to learn. The whole universe of universes is set up as a great vast school for the children of God to learn by doing. And, you know, the only time we really run into trouble is if we don't learn from our mistakes. And oftentimes that's comes from a conditioning where it's not okay to make mistakes.
Right. Yeah, where you're afraid of making a mistake because you'll be rejected.
Right.
You'll be shunned.
Or
you'll be cast out.
The consequences will be too severe. Oh,
mm-hmm.
My gosh. So severe that you have to hide your mistakes.
I think one of the big issues with corporal punishment as a behavior modification tool is that it so often caused children to not trust their caregivers. You know, if they were going to be beaten for making a mistake, or they were going to be injured, physically injured,
right,
that, you know, it was sort of inconsistent, incongruous to believe that those people or that person was really on your team.
Or to feel safe to admit that you made a mistake.
Right. It's like, I'm not going to be willing to come and tell you when I've made a mistake, or to ask for your advice, or to share my real experiences with you if I'm afraid that every time I do, you're going to beat me up.
Right. Verbally,
whether it's
or
literal
physically.
Or metaphorical.
Right. I mean, mental abuse is just as detrimental, and verbal abuse is just as detrimental. I mean, violence obviously doesn't solve anything, but reading from the board, intellectual superiority and overpowering arguments are poison.
Right.
Well, they're poisons to a marriage and a family, and they're poisons to children. Those words get in their heads, and those tapes can play for the rest of their lives.
Mm,
I'm not
indeed.
Good enough because A, B, C, D, you know, I'm not worthy.
Well, and we talked a little bit, you know, sort of about utilizing fruits of the spirit in the process, the training process of preparing people for marriage and family. And one of the things that I frequently need to reiterate with some of the females that I'm consulting, I mean, I'm sure this goes for men as well, but it tends to be something I see a little bit more often from females in a marriage, is that they want their spouse to confide in them, to talk to them about what's really going on. But the consequences are often, you know, pretty severe in that they have a hard time approaching without criticism, approaching some kind of difference of opinion without criticizing or without being without sort of pulling love away.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And
how important is that to somebody in a family, and this is a perfect segue into what we were talking about with Jesus and Jude in jail, to believe in your heart and mind that no matter what unwise thing you might do, no matter what foolish, stupid mistake you might make, or ill-conceived notion you might have, this person is still going to love you. And this person is still on your side, this parent, this spouse, this friend, this sibling, still believes that you can overcome whatever foolish thing or trap you might fall into in your life.
And I wasn't very articulate in saying what I was just trying to say before, but what I meant was that if you want people to tell you the truth,
be willing to hear it.
you have to be a safe place for people to come to tell the truth.
Right.
There has to be a safe environment for people to confide in you. So, and that, I think that does go for both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
If your spouse or your children come to you with a problem or come to you to admit some kind of mistake or some kind of decision that you may not approve of, if you're not a person who can exhibit self-control with the little things, then people are not likely to trust you to have self-control when it comes to the big things.
Right. And you know, feeling safe is so essential to any relationship. And we probably should, you know, I'll go ahead and read the last two paragraphs in this just to finish off this section.
Okay.
Because it's just so invaluable. This is more Midwayer commentary. The Midwayers were the beings that were present, the unseen friends that were present recording much of this these happenings. And they go on to say, it is our sincere belief that the gospel of Jesus' teaching, founded as it is on the father-child relationship, can hardly enjoy a worldwide acceptance until such a time as the home life of the modern civilized peoples embraces more of love and more of wisdom. Notwithstanding that parents of the 20th century possess great knowledge and increased truth for improving the home and ennobling the home life, it remains a fact that very few modern homes are such good places in which to nurture boys and girls as Jesus' home in Galilee and John Mark's home in Judea. Albeit, the acceptance of Jesus' gospel will result in the immediate improvement of home life. The love life of a wise home and the loyal devotion of true religion exert a profound reciprocal influence on each other. Such a home life enhances religion, and genuine religion always glorifies the home. It is true that many of the objectionable, stunting influences and other cramping features of these olden Jewish homes have been virtually eliminated from many of the better regulated modern homes. There is indeed more spontaneous freedom and far more personal liberty, but this liberty is not restrained by love, motivated by loyalty, nor directed by the intelligent discipline of wisdom. As long as we teach the child to pray, our Father who is in heaven, a tremendous responsibility rests upon all earthly fathers, so to live and order their homes that the word Father becomes worthily enshrined in the minds and hearts of all growing children. And I think we could easily say, too, that the same responsibility rests on mothers, that the word mother becomes worthily enshrined in the hearts and minds of all growing children, and the word family. So that's some beautiful Midwayer commentary right there, and it's so, so true. You know, if we're going to accept Jesus' gospel of the family of God, essentially, you know, the growing cosmic family of which we are all a part, cosmic citizens, if you will.
So
then,
true.
Yeah. Then the home where, and they reiterated again, you know, restrained by love, motivated by loyalty, and directed by intelligent discipline, the intelligent discipline of wisdom.
Well, and that works as a perfect segue.
It does, doesn't it? So let's go to Jude in jail and see what Jesus did.
Well, I was going to suggest that we just take a short pause and read just a couple paragraphs from Jesus's 19th year.
Okay, good, great.
It's from, gosh, now what paper is this? Is it paper 127 and section 4, the 19th year, A.D. 13. By this time, Jesus and Mary were getting along much better. She regarded him less as a son. He had become more, to her, more a father to their children. Each day's life swarmed with practical and immediate difficulties. Less frequently, they spoke of his life's work, for as time passed, all their thought was mutually devoted to the support and upbringing of their family of 4 boys and 3 girls. By the beginning of this year, Jesus had fully won his mother to the acceptance of his methods of child training. The positive injunction to do good in the place of the older Jewish method of forbidding to do evil.
Mm.
I think that is also really crucial. In his home and throughout his public teaching career, Jesus invariably employed the positive form of exhortation. Always and everywhere did he say, "You shall do this. You ought to do that." Never did he employ the negative mode of teaching derived from the ancient taboos. He refrained from placing emphasis on evil by forbidding it, while he exalted the good by commanding its performance. Prayer time in his household was the occasion for discussing anything and everything relating to the welfare of the family. Jesus began wise discipline upon his brothers and sisters at such an early age that little or no punishment was ever required to secure their prompt and wholehearted obedience. The only exception was Jude. Upon whom, on sundry occasions, Jesus found it necessary to impose penalties for his infractions of the rules of the home. On 3 occasions, when it was deemed wise to punish Jude for self-confessed and deliberate violations of the family rules of conduct, his punishment was fixed by the unanimous decree of the older children and was assented to by Jude himself before it was inflicted.
Mm.
I find that really inspiring.
I do, too.
For several reasons. One, and one that comes to mind most frequently, is that even with the creator son of a universe as your parent, you cannot guarantee that you're always going to have well-behaved children.
There you go.
There's
the
that pesky
off.
Free will. Even with the most perfect parenting probably ever witnessed, you know, there's going to be problems. There can be problems.
Of course,
and
because
then secondly,
we're not perfect children either, you know. I mean,
yeah,
we're just
indeed.
Not perfect.
And then secondly, that, you know, he always used the positive mode of placing emphasis, you know, on the good, not forbidding evil. And I think about how much more inspiring that is for children.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about, for example, let's just use, you know, one of my favorite fruits of the spirit, but courageous loyalty as a as something that you're admonishing or something that you're hoping to inspire in your children. When you talk about or you tell stories or share fairy tales or
family lore yeah,
about what it's like to stand up for the values you believe in. What if, you know, what does it look like to exhibit courageous loyalty in the face of possible betrayal? You know, those kinds of things can be so inspiring to children. And we can often be surprised by how mature and how courageous young children can be in the face of real difficulty.
Yes.
When they are inspired by those kinds of pictures of glory.
It's like one of those little boys in that school shooting who told the adults, "I know karate, follow me."
Oh my.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Mhm.
To see, you know, bravery and willing to risk oneself for the welfare of others is one of the noblest of human traits. And children possess enough of just the, you know, it really is, education is drawing that out in them,
mm-hmm.
more than anything. And I think by Jesus' exhortation to good, his positive example, or his always calling, how did it say that he commanded the good? It gives them permission to bring that out because it's in them. And so you draw it out by giving it a place to reveal itself, rather than always putting it in the negative. It's what, you know, the minute you tell somebody they can't do something,
mm-hmm.
now they're obsessed with doing that one thing.
Right.
You know?
And, you know, we find out that, you know, young children who have a really strict upbringing, or kids who have a really lax upbringing, they both exhibit almost the same kinds of negative traits of delinquency when they get out on their own,
mm-hmm.
when they get out from under that household influence. And so they need to have an environment where they can be testing those muscles, building those muscles all along, so that when they come of age, when they get out on their own, they're not sort of starting from scratch of making decisions and suffering the consequences.
Right. But and as our friend Sun Sista on the board has pointed out, and I love this, Sun, thank you so much. She says, what do you think about parents who model their parenting after God and take a hands-off approach by not interfering in their decision processes? Teens may not want to go to school, eat very poor diets, break the laws. And she said, you know, God may let somebody walk in front of a car, but a parent shouldn't. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, actually, you know, God does take a hands-on approach with us because he gives us a fragment of himself to live and dwell within our minds, and we spend the rest of our lives trying to figure out what it is the wisdom he's trying to impart to us. So it's a subtle approach. The Heavenly Father isn't trying to force or coerce us into doing something, the right thing. But what about, you know, what should we do as parents? We can't force or coerce children. You know, it's interesting because when they're little, certainly, you know, you don't want them to walk in front of a car. You don't want them to walk out from between two parked cars. You don't want them to run out in the street ever. You don't want them to get their hands on poisons. You want them to have a healthy diet. You want them to, you know, you want to teach them how to take care of themselves. And that's our job, I think, as parents. And then and as they grow through various stages, then they get better at doing certain things, then you give them more and more freedom. And they earn that freedom, I think, by showing that they're responsible people, by showing that they've learned these basic lessons. And if you're a hands-on parent and a caring parent, of course you're going to teach your children these things because they're so precious to you. You want them to survive. So in a way, you are doing God's job. God gives children parents for a reason.
We have a material environment where we start out that is fairly restrictive, that just naturally provides certain restrictions.
That's true.
And that's one of the ways that God does provide some guidelines or some imposes some structure.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, we don't have unbridled freedom in this material environment. We also have, you know, instant consequences for certain kinds of default decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing too is that this is a mercy dominated universe, and we don't always have to pay immediate consequences for some of our poor decisions. We have so much mercy, so many mercy credits, and I think to that extent also when parenting is just strict and just rigid in terms of things like making healthy decisions and choosing the right foods and doing the right, focusing a lot on a work ethic, when there aren't any indulgences that are ever allowed, then when kids get out on their own, they're much more likely not to be able to handle the temptation. So you sort of have to have the balance there, too.
Oh, for sure. And it is, like I said, the most difficult and most important job anybody ever does. And it's almost built in for people who love their children. And I think most parents do. You know, we've heard stories about parents who don't love their children and abuse them and mistreat them. And that's very, very sad. But I think the vast majority of parents truly love their children. Truly, truly love their children. And I think that parenthood brings something to you that is just so pervasive in that you it's so natural for you to love this being more than you love yourself and to forget yourself in order to give this being what they need to be comfortable and happy. And to make, personal sacrifices. I always used to tell people, before I had children, I took a bath when I wanted. I read a book when I wanted. I came and go when I went. I did what I wanted to do. After you have children, though, you do things all around them. When, if they're taking a nap, you run out for, and have a cup of coffee or take a hot bath, but you keep an ever listening ear out for that little voice. And, you're just, it's such a pervasive responsibility, and you are so focused in on their welfare, and you care so much about them. I think it's almost like that's what leads us to make mistakes as much as loving them too much. And I guess that's what we've been saying. It's just as bad as not loving them enough, but you can't love them too much, but you can overindulge them and you can give them too much. And you can, spoil their concept of themselves and make them think that they're more important than other people. And, so it is a dance we do, and it does take, we do have to edit ourselves and edit our own parenting skills. And we do have to take ourselves in hand sometime and say to ourselves, am I really doing them a service?
Well, and on that topic, I want to read just a little bit more of that section.
Okay.
While Jesus was most methodical and systematic in everything he did, there was also in his administrative rulings a refreshing elasticity of interpretation and an individuality of adaptation that greatly impressed all the children with the spirit of justice which actuated their father brother. He never arbitrarily disciplined his brothers and sisters, and such uniform fairness and personal consideration greatly endeared Jesus to all his family. James and Simon grew up trying to follow Jesus' plan of placating their bellicose and sometimes irate playmates by persuasion and non-resistance, and they were fairly successful. But Joseph and Jude, while assenting to such teachings at home, made haste to defend themselves when assailed by their comrades. In particular, was Jude guilty of violating the spirit of these teachings. But non-resistance was not a rule of the family. Hmm. No penalty was attached to the violation of personal teachings. In general, all of the children, particularly the girls, would consult Jesus about their childhood troubles and confide in him just as they would have an affectionate father.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's a great section. And I highly recommend it. So let's go on now to the Jude getting in real trouble.
And our friend Andre is on with us. Hello, Andre.
Yay, Andre.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Back on that Eastern time zone.
Welcome to Cosmic Citizen.
Thank you. Back on that midnight shift and all that good stuff. So good to be with you.
Good to
and,
be with you too.
Good to hear as well. You know, that quote about James and Simon. To me, I'm just trying to relate to that. You know, 2,000 years ago, James and Simon were not punished for violating personal teachings that were part of the family. You know, just that idea of there being that kind of leadership of their father, brother, Jesus, but with no authoritarian aspect, that the love was more important than the authority, that's just mind-blowing.
Well,
that's
and
not
I
how
love
I grew
that,
up.
That term of the elasticity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a marvelous quote. That's so indicative of so many things about how Jesus fathered and therefore how Jesus fathers.
Right.
How we're being fathered right now.
Yeah. Well, that occurred to me this morning as I was thinking about this show. He is still the father of this universe. And he still is raising us up as spiritual sons and daughters. He had that very real experience of raising material sons and daughters on a material world, but he has a greater responsibility to raise all of us up as spiritual sons and daughters who truly do possess eternal potential.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is really important for some of us who seem to find ourselves regularly on the wayward path to somewhere or to nowhere. that was gratifying to hear that.
Well, and before we talk about Jude's incident, there's one other part from that paper where from paper 127.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're told that Jude was a firebrand.
Mm-hmm.
He had the highest of ideals, but he was unstable in temperament.
Mm.
He had all and more of his mother's determination and aggressiveness, but he lacked much of her sense of proportion and discretion.
Isn't it interesting how sometimes even a good, and I believe this firmly, you know, your greatest strength is often your greatest weakness as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just could cut either way. And a wise parent will help you learn to use that and hone that, you know. Avoid the pitfalls of that, but use that as a benefit in your life. I remember thinking when my daughter Jean was young, she was so determined. Oh my gosh, she's a determined child. She is determined to get what she wants and needs. And I used to think, boy, this is really tough. But then I would remember that someday it'll be a real asset to her. Her determination will be an asset.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to raise a child like her who's determined to get what she wants, you know, and she doesn't give up. But someday, that will be an asset in her life.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to break that.
And sure enough.
You want to temper it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, what's really unusual is you having a child like that, Paula, considering you're not determined at all to get anything you want.
Imagine Paula having
Touché.
A determined daughter.
Yeah.
Touché, Andre.
You know, people have never that have gotten to know you have never mistaken kindness for weakness. Or at least they ought not to.
They ought not.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think, and so let's do, while we still have time, go ahead and share that story with Jude, because I think there again is such an essential lesson of Jesus' love and patience and tolerance. And as we pointed out last week, tolerance and forbearance and patience and altruism, these are the lessons that are learned in family life.
Mm-hmm.
And they're essential to our success in everything else. these are the and parents and children learn them alike. I mean, the whole family experience is beneficial to every member, right? I know you guys agree. Parents learn the lessons as well as the children do. We all learn them together. And if we didn't get them in our own nuclear family growing up, we can certainly get them in the family we create. And we can create an environment where we learn the lessons as well as the children, and we learn them together.
Yeah.
And that's a powerful thing, to grow up with your children and to feel like they have something to teach you. You know, we said last week, I think, Jesus told Ganon the true teacher maintains his integrity by ever remaining a learner.
And so, that was certainly true of Jesus throughout. Because in the background, he was all the while trying to learn about his fellow men and women on this planet during this period of his life.
Yes.
So go ahead. Where are you taking us?
Well, we are. You want to read it, Andre? It would be great if you did. It's
sure,
number 128,
sure. Yeah.
Section 6, paragraph 5.
And I'd sure, like to suggest we start a little bit earlier than paragraph 5.
Okay,
because
go ahead.
You get a little bit more about the background of Jesus' deciding how to deal with this trip.
Okay.
Before Jude gets in trouble. So why don't you start at the beginning of section 6? We've got time to read through that whole section, I think.
Yeah, I think so, and it reads like a story, so we don't really have to stop. Just take it away, Andre.
Okay. This year began with the Nazareth family all in good health. Oh, wait, in that section, by the way, is entitled The 25th Year, AD 19. This year began with the Nazareth family all in good health and witnessed the finishing of the regular schooling of all the children with the exception of certain work which Martha must do for Ruth. Jesus was one of the most robust and refined specimens of manhood to appear on earth since the days of Adam. His physical development was superb. His mind was active, keen, and penetrating. Compared with the average mentality of his contemporaries, it had developed gigantic proportions. And his spirit was indeed humanly divine. The family's finances were in the best condition since the disappearance of Joseph's estate. The final payments had been made on the caravan repair shop. They owed no man, and for the first time in years had some funds ahead. This being true, and since he had taken the other brothers to Jerusalem for their first Passover ceremonies, Jesus decided to accompany Jude, who had just graduated from the synagogue school, on his first visit to the temple. They went up to Jerusalem and returned by the same route, the Jordan Valley, as Jesus feared trouble if he took his young brother through Samaria. Already at Nazareth, Jude had got into slight trouble several times because of his hasty disposition, coupled with his strong patriotic sentiments. They arrived at Jerusalem in due time and were on their way for a first visit to the temple, the very sight of which had stirred and thrilled Jude to the very depth of his soul. When they chanced to meet Lazarus of Bethany, while Jesus talked with Lazarus and sought to arrange for their joint celebration of the Passover, Jude started up real trouble for them all. Close at hand stood a Roman guard who made some improper remarks regarding a Jewish girl who was passing. Jude flushed with fiery indignation and was not slow in expressing his resentment of such an impropriety directly to and within hearing of the soldier. Now, the Roman legionnaires were very sensitive to anything bordering on Jewish disrespect, so the guard promptly placed Jude under arrest. This was too much for the young patriot, and before Jesus could caution him by a warning glance, he had delivered himself of a voluble denunciation of pent-up anti-Roman feelings, all of which only made a bad matter worse. Jude, with Jesus by his side, was taken at once to the military prison. Jesus endeavored to obtain either an immediate hearing for Jude or else his release in time for the Passover celebration that evening. But he failed in these attempts. Since the next day was a holy convocation in Jerusalem, even the Romans would not presume to hear charges against a Jew. Accordingly, Jude remained in confinement until the morning of the second day after his arrest, and Jesus stayed at the prison with him. They were not present in the temple at the ceremony of receiving the sons of the law into the full citizenship of Israel. Jude did not pass through his formal ceremony for several years until he was next in Jerusalem at a Passover and in connection with his propaganda work in behalf of the Zealots, the patriotic organization to which he belonged and in which he was very active. The morning following their second day in prison, Jesus appeared before the military magistrate in behalf of Jude. By making apologies for his brother's youth and by a further explanatory but judicious statement with reference to the provocative nature of the episode which had led up to the arrest of his brother, Jesus so handled the case that the magistrate expressed the opinion that the young Jew might have had some possible excuse for his violent outburst. After warning Jude not to allow himself again to be guilty of such rashness, he said to Jesus in dismissing them, "You had better keep your eye on the lad. He's liable to make a lot of trouble for all of you." And the Roman judge spoke the truth. Jude did make considerable trouble for Jesus, and always was the trouble of this same nature, clashes with the civil authorities because of his thoughtless and unwise patriotic outbursts. Jesus and Jude walked over to Bethany for the night, explaining why they had failed to keep their appointment for the Passover supper, and set out for Nazareth the following day. Jesus did not tell the family about his younger brother's arrest at Jerusalem, but he had a long talk with Jude about this episode some 3 weeks after their return. After this talk with Jesus, Jude himself told the family he never forgot the patience and forbearance his brother-father manifested throughout the whole of this trying experience. This was the last Passover Jesus attended with any member of his own family. Increasingly, the Son of Man was to become separated from close association with his own flesh and blood. This year, his seasons of deep meditation were often broken into by Ruth and her playmates, and always was Jesus ready to postpone the contemplation of his future work for the world and the universe that he might share in the childish joy and youthful gladness of these youngsters who never tired of listening to Jesus relate the experience of his various trips to Jerusalem. They also greatly enjoyed his stories about animals and nature. The children were always welcome at the repair shop. Jesus provided sand, blocks, and stones by the side of the shop, and bevies of youngsters flocked there to amuse themselves. When they tired of their play, the more intrepid ones would peek into the shop, and if its keeper were not busy, they would make bold to go in and say, "Uncle Joshua, come out and tell us a big story." Then they would lead him out by tugging at his hands until he was seated on the favorite rock by the corner of the shop, with the children on the ground in a semicircle before him. And how the little folks did enjoy their Uncle Joshua! They were learning to laugh, and to laugh heartily. It was customary for one or two of the smallest of the children to climb upon his knees and sit there, looking up in wonderment at his expressive features as he told his stories. The children loved Jesus, and Jesus loved the children. It was difficult for his friends to comprehend the range of his intellectual activities, how he could so suddenly and so completely swing from the profound discussion of politics, philosophy, or religion to the lighthearted and joyous playfulness of these tots of from 5 to 10 years of age. As his own brothers and sisters grew up, as he gained more leisure, and before the grandchildren arrived, he paid a great deal of attention to these little ones. but he did not live on earth long enough to enjoy the grandchildren very much.
Mm. I love that whole section. It's just such an amazing section. And
I always get very emotional hearing that.
Yeah, me too. Because it's interesting that they put those two items together, this episode with Jude at the, you know, at the temple and his pent-up anti-Roman sentiments and that whole difficult situation and how Jesus handled that with patience and forbearance and wisdom, tremendous wisdom. As you can see, he waited 3 weeks before he even talked it over with Jude. Let Jude think about it first. Wanted Jude to have ample time to process what had just happened before he, you know, gave him his words of advice and wisdom about the whole matter. And
what a
Jude
high
himself,
level of patience.
Oh, man. Because you would just be so tempted to say, now, Jude, all the way home.
Right.
You know, all the way home on the long walk home. Your perfect opportunity to lecture endlessly about why what you did was wrong and stupid and foolish, you know. But
well, and how unnecessary.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Jude would be well aware of how much trouble he had caused by then.
Exactly. And I have a little indicator here that our friend Lee would like to contribute, so I'm going to put her through. Hi, Lee.
Okay.
Are you there, Lee? She may be on.
Oh, sorry. I had to unmute myself.
Oh, sure. No problem.
Been a really wonderful... Hi, Andre. You have a beautiful reading voice.
He does, doesn't he? Wow.
Oh, yeah. It's great. I just closed my eyes and sort of meditated. It was wonderful. You know, I wanted to speak about something that you started this show with, which was that if a child doesn't have wise parents during the first 8 years of life, it greatly affects all the years thereafter. And I myself used to think that pretty much doomed you if you didn't have that. But it's like Chris always says, no, you have to unpack it. And like, what are they asking you to look at? And recently, I found an author. Her name is Margaret Paul, and she has this site on the web.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, Inner Bonding is her site. And she offers teaches a process of reparenting yourself, which is based on spiritual principles. And she calls God higher power because she's on the web, but, you know, still it's the same. And one of the principles is that God is present in the quality of our inner relationships, our relationship to ourselves, and that God can, like, you know, can and will influence the way we relate to ourselves if we invite that. And then I added a second spiritual principle to that, to her approach, which is that unless you become as a little child, you won't enter the kingdom of God.
Oh,
because,
beautiful.
Because her whole approach is about rediscovering that child who kind of got smushed by having unwise parents. And like one of the things, the child is important inside of us because it manifests innocence and fully living in the present. It bears our trust and our faith. It carries our sense of awe and wonder at the world and our experience of joy, our sensitivity to life, our curiosity and our heartfulness. So you can't afford to smush that part of yourself and do, you know, and think you're going to do well. And then, so what she says is that in childhood, when a child gets hurt or frightened, if the parent is wise, they'll comfort and reassure the child. And then she makes this point about, and above all, they'll tell the child the truth about the situation. Like, if the child had an impatient teacher, the mother will say, well, yes, the teacher was impatient, but you're still a very valuable person, and there's nothing or no one who can diminish your value because God established your value, basically. But then the mother will go on to have a learning attitude like, okay, now what can we learn from what happened with the teacher? And kind of go from there. And she says, but what when the child doesn't get this, and instead the child, like, you know, gets ignored or diminished for being upset, or maybe they're even ridiculed for getting in trouble with a teacher, then the child will internalize what Margaret Paul calls the unloving parent. And this unloving parent then continues to, like, work with that child the rest of that person's life, and that person basically becomes the unloving parent, and the child gets marginalized, the inner child. And I thought of that, Paula, when you talked about how Jesus said he didn't know if he could count on that youth of the unwise parents in later life.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if you do internalize the unloving parent, you're always going to be unstable, because there's no stability in having an unloving inner parent. So her process for reparenting, so that you can sort of get a balance of inner relationships that are, that foster integration, basically maturity and integration, is that you start writing out dialogues between your inner child and your inner parent. And she said, when you do that, you'll get a chance to see how the unloving parent, the unloving inner parent sounds, and then you'll also get a chance to hear from the child, who basically hasn't been heard from since the first years of life. Its voice has been snuffed.
Right.
But she said, you will not get to hear from that child unless you go in with an attitude of being willing to learn. And you have to really humble yourself and be willing to learn. But from that process, eventually you can then develop an inner loving parent, because you see what the child needs, you see what your internal unloving parent has been doing. So you move towards what feels better. And her point is that the whole process is fostered by, what she calls the higher power. And I think, yes, that is true. But it's especially true if you ask God, to foster the process.
Of course, absolutely.
Yeah, because you're throwing open wide the gates that way. And she's not a religious person, so she doesn't go into that. But she does definitely make this whole process rely on the presence of spirit.
I'm so glad you brought her up, because she's one of my heroes in terms of learning how to educate and develop those interpersonal skills, increase our effectiveness at parenting and family rearing or just being a cosmic citizen. Her work with her husband, Jordan, was really life-changing for me. They wrote a book called Do I Have to Let Go of Me to Be Loved by You? Probably 30 years ago.
Wow.
And it was such a brilliant treatise on how to deal with conflict in relationship, and how to maintain passion and feelings of being in love, and how to keep relationships romantically alive. I would love to have her on this program.
Wouldn't that be great? What's her name again?
Margaret Paul.
Paul, huh? I'm going to look her up and read Inner Bonding, you said, is the name of the website.
Well, the website is Inner Bonding, but the book that where she lays out this whole process is called Healing Your Aloneness. And what the aloneness refers to is that little child who gets pushed aside and never heard from again and feels just terribly alone. And one reason this process is hard for just about anybody who tries it, including me, is because once you rediscover that inner child, you have to be willing to feel their feelings.
Right.
And that those are painful.
Wow. Yeah, and I think it's so crucial to mental health.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Because so many of those blocks come because we're not willing to feel uncomfortable feelings.
Well, and again, we weren't safe to feel them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody created a safe place for us to feel them. So now if we're going to create a safe place, I think your point is, Lee, they may come all flooding up at once, and you just have to get through that. And I've heard stories from other people who were in therapy, and the therapy was designed to do just exactly this. And when those emotions all came flooding up, all the hurt, all the anger, all the fear, all the aloneness, they had to deal with it, and it was quite a process. Sometimes it took a couple of years to get through all of the emotions that came flooding up once there was a safe place for the child to express what was actually going on.
The other thing I really appreciate about her work is she has the books that she writes, but most of her books come with a workbook.
Oh.
So that it's not just a passive experience of reading, but then she'll take you through pretty much like the same kind of thing you would go through in therapy. You know, various exercises to go through with yourself to really practice what she's preaching.
Well, the Healing Your Aloneness book, it's not a workbook, but boy, what's so
helpful to me
is... No,
she has a workbook that comes with it.
Oh, I'll have to find out about that, because there are many examples in that book of how that dialogue can sound, and boy, that really helped me a lot.
The workbook teaches that six-step process. So, I highly recommend the workbook going along with the...
You mean the workbook to
Healing Your Aloneness workbook, yeah.
Wow, awesome. Thank you.
Well, you know, and you're right. Something that helps you understand what that might sound like gives you kind of it helps you recognize it. And I think, you know, it's just like anything when we're dealing with the inner life, when we share the inner life with each other, you know, I think it helps us understand sometimes how God works in our life and you know, what it feels like to feel God's love. And especially for people that don't have a concept of that, they don't have an experience of that. Sometimes if you share that inner life with others, that spiritual life with others, it helps them to recognize it in themselves. Recognize the parental voice, too, you know, like the negative tapes that play.
Indeed.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. But that's been the biggest process of discovery is hearing all of that, you know, that goes on, and it's so great to see it on paper. It's so horrible and great at the same time, but my inner child, like, loves it so much. It's like she recommends you do the dialogue, written dialogue for half an hour a day, but it's like, oh, no, let's just do it all the time, you know. I have so much to say, you know. Yeah,
my inner child hasn't had somebody to listen to it since it was, you know, for the last 50 years. So let's just go for it.
What amusing thing is she said usually the internalized unloving parent is usually either authoritarian or laissez-faire. And I thought, but my internalized parent is both, because my dad was authoritarian and my mom was laissez-faire. And so it's, you know, sometimes I'll just like, get into that, like, really rigid, overbearing, you know, you have to, or you're really, the world, sky's going to fall. And then the counter to that will be, like, whatever. You know, there's no middle ground there.
Whatever.
And that's what we're all seeking, is middle ground. We're seeking balance. That's, you know.
Well, that incredible balance, you know, like we were just talking about with Jesus, you know, he had the ability to personalize and, you know, the situation for each kid that he was dealing with.
Right.
It wasn't any kind of a carte blanche system.
Well, and just quickly, because we're actually running out of time, and that happens so often because we just get into the conversation and then we have to go. But I wanted to bring up that later, you know, Jude's brothers got together and decided they wanted Jude out of the family. It was just enough, too much. You know, he pushed the boundaries once too often, and the brothers, the older brothers of the family, were ready to just disown Jude. And Jesus admonished them to, you know, let's be wise, let's be patient. Let's bear with him a little longer. And he went out and he married a good woman, and he changed. It mellowed him out. It balanced him. It was just what he needed. And how often, you know, life is like that. It brings us what we need for our balance. And if we bear with each other, we'll see those beautiful transformations. But if we give up on each other, we won't. So there's such a great lesson there that Jesus foresaw that Jude would be okay. His brothers didn't have that foresight, but he helped them with that.
And Jesus never gives up on any of us.
No, he never.
He didn't give up then. He doesn't give up now.
And you know what? If he did, we would all be in bad trouble, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So
I think that's a wonderful admonition to end on, you know, that really the real key to... raising cosmic citizens is to never give up on them, to never give up on each other, to continue to strive and have faith with one another.
And Merry Christmas to all of our listeners, and you know, may you hold that love of the perfect parent in your heart, the parent that never gives up, the parent that always has faith in you and knows that you can persevere and achieve great things in life.
Amen.
Amen.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Lee.
Join us again as we continue this series next week.
Awesome.
Okay.
Right.
And until then,
okay,
bye
God
for
bless.
Now.
Bye.
Bye for now.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind